The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, special edition, the evening of Thursday, January 4th, 2018. The New York Times this evening produced a surprising news story on obstruction of justice and the investigation of it. The lead reads, President Trump gave firm instructions in March to White House top lawyer stop the Attorney General Jeff Sessions from recusing himself in the Justice Department's investigation into whether Mr. Trump's associates had helped a Russian campaign to disrupt the 2016 election. We put together an emergency podcast by recorded conference call, so forgive the audio quality. I have on the line with me Mike Schmidt of the New York Times, whose byline graces the story, Susan Hennessy, Lawfare's executive editor, Jack Goldsmith, who needs no introduction to this audience, and Bob Bauer, a former White House counsel under President Obama. Let's start with Mike. So, Mike, this is quite a story, and it covers a huge amount of ground. Walk us through what you guys reported tonight.
Tonight we reported a series of things. One, that the president had instructed his top lawyer, Don McGahn, to lobby Sessions not to recuse himself from the Russia investigation. We reported that a Sessions aide had approached a Hill staffer the Friday before Comey was fired, asking whether the staffer had any dirt on Comey. We also learned that the president described the Russia investigation as politically motivated in a letter that he wanted to send Comey, that the White House counsel's office stopped him from sending. The president said that the Russia investigation was fabricated and made up. And I'm trying to think what else. There's a lot of different things in there and unpacking it all. But those are the major. Oh, the last thing being that a lawyer in the White House counsel's office had basically misled the president about whether the president had the authority to fire the FBI director, whether the president could do it with or without cause. And the lawyer had told the president that he needed a reason to fire the FBI director. But after the lawyer found out from lawyers in the White House counsel's office who looked into it that he didn't need a reason, he did not go back and correct it with the president. He actually, in subsequent meetings with the president, did not tell him that he could do it without cause, because he feared the implications of firing Comey. So sort of looking at different things that Mueller has kicked up in the course of his investigation about questions of obstruction.
Now, so you describe these throughout the story as matters that Mueller has picked up, as you just said. And I guess one thing you didn't you sort of alluded to in the story, but don't say explicitly, is that this is a matter, or this sequence of events seems to be a matter of active investigation by the Mueller people. Is that, are you confident of that, that this sequence is something that Mueller's people are actively looking at right now?
These are all things that Mueller has learned either through documents provided to him by the White House counsel's office, or learned through interviews with White House officials who were there for all of these events. These are things that they have been questioned about. These are things Mueller's investigators are asking about. And these are documents that they're looking at. So that is how we got to where we were on understanding what Mueller has and, you know, what Mueller will have to look at as he considers what to do with an obstruction case.
Mike, I don't want to ask you about your sources, but I was very interested in the part of the story where you describe Sessions' aide asking a Hill staffer for dirt on Jim Comey and saying that the Attorney General wants one disparaging story about him per day. And this is a quite striking part of the story because it's the one part that the administration in the form of the Justice Department spokeswoman is on the record in the story denying that the incident happened. And I'm interested in, you know, you report that it happened. She says it didn't happen. What should I make of that?
Well, we only publish things that we believe are true. We did a fair amount of diligence on this piece of information to understand what had gone on, and we got to a place that we felt comfortable about it. I think that the Justice Department did not like the notion, obviously, that Mr. Sessions was digging up dirt on someone that was still working at the Justice Department, and they wanted to be clear that he didn't know anything about this and then had not authorized anything along these lines, and that this was something he knew nothing about. At the end of the day, we felt comfortable with the information that we had, and that's why we posted.
So with there's another part where you describe the administration, not in this case the Justice Department, but saying things that are, you know, not true, which is you mentioned that White House lawyers had said to the New York Times that there was no mention of the Russia investigation in the Bedminster memorandum, and that you believe that the first sentence of the Bedminster memo calls the Russian investigation fabricated and politically motivated. In another part of the story, citing Michael Wolff's book, you talk about how Mark Corallo seems to have quit over the Trump Tower statement prepared in the president's company on Air Force One. There's a series of parts of this story where you're basically reporting that information that the White House or the Justice Department is putting out isn't true. You know, that's not something that you guys do lightly, or that, you know, I know you personally do lightly. So I'm just interested for your thoughts on it.
Well, we had written a story back over the summer about the letter that Trump wanted to send Comey that the White House counsel's office thought was problematic, which was sort of this rant that he had done with Stephen Miller at Bedminster the weekend before. And, you know, we had been told that there were mentions of Russia, you know, related to the Russia investigation in there. And when we had gone to the White House at the time, they had told us that there were not mentions of the Russia investigation in there. And when we did more reporting and learned about the letter, we learned that the president had described the Russian investigation as fabricated and politically motivated. And we thought that that was an important piece of information, that in the same letter that the president is firing the FBI, the president's firing the FBI director, he's calling this investigation, you know, something that is basically made up. We thought that that was significant, and it was worth pointing out that the White House had told us that it didn't mention the Russian investigation, and that this had described it in, certainly in disparaging detail.
So one of the other, as you work your way through this story, one of the other things you report is that there are a number of areas in which Mueller has been able to verify or validate things that were in Jim Comey's memoranda and testimony, and that there were handwritten notes from Reince Priebus showing that Trump had in fact talked to him about how he had called Comey to get him to say Trump wasn't under investigation. So is your impression that as the Mueller investigation proceeds, it is generally validating the public statements that Jim Comey made in his testimony, or Or are these isolated things that they've been able to validate?
We thought this was significant because there had been such a push by Trump to call Comey a liar. So anything that sort of tries to answer that question, whether Comey had provided misleading information or not, we think is significant. We don't know a lot about what other folks have said in regards to Comey's memos beyond what we reported tonight. But the thing is that a lot of the witnesses to that are FBI officials who Comey talked to at the time, who he told about what was going on. And the other folks will be White House officials who may have witnessed these things, that may have seen the president clear the room on February 14th so he could speak directly with Comey, who had guys like Reince Priebus, who may have talked to the president after the president had interactions with Comey or during those interactions. So these are things that that get to a further, better understanding of what the Comey memos mean and what other people know about them. And, obviously the president has been very forceful against Comey, continuing to attack him. And this begins to answer some of those questions.
Finally, the story leads with this amazing incident in which first Trump instructs Don McGahn to lobby Sessions on recusal, and then McGahn does so and then backs down when Sessions says he'd been advised by career officials at Justice to recuse, and McGahn sort of backs down at that point. But that Trump is livid about this and describes wanting a Roy Cohn and comparing Sessions unfavorably to Eric Holder, who had, in his judgment, protected Obama.
He's actually saying that Eric Holder protected Obama. He's saying that is a good thing. He's saying that Bobby Kennedy protected JFK and Holder protected Obama. And he's saying, where's my Roy Cohn? Where's the guy who's going to protect me?
So you actually spoke with the president directly about this in your impromptu interview with him a couple weeks ago. One of the things I was really struck by in that interview is that he doesn't seem to understand that sounds like he's advocating corruption.
In the interview, when I spoke to him last week, he says, look, I can do whatever I want with the Justice Department. Certainly things that if Barack Obama or any other president, that people would have gone absolutely nuts about. He says, oh, but I've stayed out of that because, I think, Mueller's going to be fair to me and stuff. But he will say that. I mean, he thinks that is just expressing his powers as the president of the United States.
Is your impression that when he does that, he understands or that he doesn't understand how that comes off? I mean, he's speaking in the presence of an obstruction of justice investigation that is, necessarily focused on things like motive, right? And motive and intention. And when he says, I need, a fixer, I need somebody who's going to protect me against an investigation, does he understand how that must sound to a Bob Mueller?
I don't think so. I think he's more interested in sort of explaining how he views his power and his authority. I don't think that he is that concerned with optics on issues like that.
Mike Schmidt, thanks so much for joining us. We'll look forward to your continued work on this and other subjects.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Where to start, guys? Who wants to get us started? There's a lot of different threads of this story. Jack, get us started. What's most salient here to you?
Well, I don't know. There are a lot of interesting tidbits in the story. I think the most extraordinary thing in the story is, there are many extraordinary things in the story. One that obviously jumps out is the effort by the president to have his White House counsel try to persuade the attorney general not to recuse himself from the Russia investigation. an attempt that failed. And amazingly, the story says it's because Mr. Sessions had already, that Jeff Sessions had already been advised by the career lawyers in the Justice Department that he needed to recuse himself given the facts. And then the story says that McGahn, the White House counsel, backed down at that point. But the fact that the president asked the attorney general to do this, excuse me, the White House counsel to do this, and the fact that the White House counsel tried is pretty extraordinary.
Okay, so Bob, you've been the White House. I happen to have a White House counsel right here to go all Woody Allen on you. President Obama says to you, please, Bob, go lobby Eric Holder not to recuse himself. What's the,
from an investigation of the White House.
Right, and that possibly involves, you know, his own conduct. I know the first thing you're going to say is Barack Obama would have never asked that of me. Yeah, so, but what's your reaction if the president you work for asks that of you?
Well, I first have to sort of slide myself in the position of Don McGahn and try to imagine what it would be like to hear that instruction from Donald Trump. And I have to try to put my response in the context of my overall plan for managing Donald Trump. So I'm obviously speculating. I think that if he were hell-bent for leather on this subject, which apparently, according to Mike Schmidt, he was, I probably would turn it around with the president and say, well, why don't I just find out what reasons he has for believing he must recuse himself, and let's just leave it there. And then I would speak to Sessions, and Sessions would tell me what his reasons were. I would relay them to the president and tell him that the matter was settled. And then at least it would not have been couched, again, speaking of the overall management of the client, as an attempt on my part to act on his behalf in stopping the recusal. It would be more a clarification of the reasons why Sessions had concluded he could not recuse himself. That's what I would think was the most that McGahn could hope for if he was trying to deal with a volcanic Donald Trump.
When you read the story, Bob, what was the part that jumped out at you as most striking?
Certainly the story about the lawyer who is described as having faked the legal conclusion or withheld the legal conclusion about the president's authority to fire Comey was striking. It raises all sorts of questions with me. Did he consult with Don McGahn? I mean, it seemed as if a junior lawyer made a decision to withhold a legal conclusion about his high firing authority, and that doesn't seem plausible, but it's possible that that happened. But I thought that was quite extraordinary, and I wonder whether, in fact, that's the whole story. I wonder whether the younger lawyer's legal conclusion, once it was filtered through the judgment that the White House counsel wanted to apply here, was not a conclusion they felt they could pass on in quite so unqualified form to the president. Maybe they thought there were risks that, you know, maybe too nuanced for the president to grasp, but made it prudent for them to leave the original advice in place, which was that there were risks to him in firing Comey, and that actually would have been the right advice.
Could I just add something to that?
Yeah, please.
I was just going to say that I too find that story implausible as it was told. It's very hard to believe that a junior lawyer would be, without McGahn's knowledge, figuring out whether the president could fire the FBI director and advising the president contrary to the law without McGahn knowing about it. Moreover, another thing that didn't ring true in the story is there's no ambiguity about this. This person worked in the Justice Department before. There's a clear Justice Department opinion that says the president can fire the FBI director. It's happened before. So that whole part of the story, I just got the feeling that there's much more to that story than Schmidt was able to tell us.
Susan, what jumped out at you?
Yeah, so I think as we get these new sort of obstruction-focused stories, I always try and return back to sort of, all right, what are the elements of the crime, and does this actually advance us on any of those prongs? So sort of to revisit broadly, you know, you have to know, there has to be a pending proceeding, right, a qualifying investigation. The defendant has to know about it, and then you have to corruptly endeavor, you know, to influence, obstruct, or impede. I think the language is the due and proper administration of the law or something like that. So I think it's worth sort of looking at this story and saying, okay, what pieces of this actually sort of move the ball forward or potentially open up new lines of inquiries on those substantive elements? And then what is more sort of interesting color and potentially interesting color that goes to sort of the mental state question. So the things that sort of jumped out at me was, one, it does describe sort of two new categories of attempted or of activity. One is the efforts to actually get Sessions not to recuse himself. And then there's also sort of that one of Sessions' staffers had a communication with the Hill staffer about having sort of derogatory information about Jim Comey. Of course, that's pretty dramatically at odds with the purported reason why Trump said he was firing Comey based on that Rosenstein memo, which is that the Bureau and the public had lost confidence in Comey. Now we're hearing that reportedly they were actually working themselves to sort of expressly undermine that confidence. The other sort of piece that I think is new information is that memo that was drafted at the president's New Jersey home did in fact reference Russia. So I think those are sort of the two new scoopy pieces there. And then there's lots that go to that question. You know, the element that I think is the open question and the hardest one to sort of prove and think about here is, did Trump act with a corrupt purpose, as that needs to be defined for the president of the United States? There's lots of evidence and color in this story about the fact that other people around him are acting as though they're concerned that he's working with a corrupt purpose. One thing, though, is that, you know, I have to go back to sort of that Lester Holt interview in which Trump pretty much says he fired Comey because of the Russia investigation. So all of this extra stuff that we're hearing about how mad he was and what he communicated to staffers and when, I don't know that advances the ball all that much, in part because, you know, he's already kind of told us on camera, you know, what his mental state was. And I don't know how much, I don't know how much further beyond that you can possibly hope to get.
Especially since, Trump will claim, and he has claimed, that the reason he's against the investigation is because he thinks it's fabricated and politically motivated. And that's basically what he told Lester Holt, too, as I recall. And I don't think there's anything in this story that's inconsistent with that, whether it's salient or not for possible obstruction. I just want to note that I'm probably in the minority in this crowd in being both skeptical that I think it's very hard to actually prosecute the president for many reasons, both on the law and just on the law of obstruction, given that he's the president, and whether you can prosecute the president, sitting president. But setting that aside, I just think there's zero chance that Mueller is going to actually do that. I think the relevant question is, will Mueller have enough factual evidence that he can document in a report that will make it seem like to the public and to Congress that the president acted corruptly? So I don't think, my own view is that parsing the obstruction statute is not what Mueller is going to be doing.
I sort of agree with that. I certainly agree that, first of all, I agree that you can't indict the sitting president. But secondly, I also agree that the application of the obstruction statutes to presidential action is extremely difficult when those actions are reasonably encompassed within his authorities as president. That said, I do think the text of the obstruction statutes are important for a couple of reasons. One is that unless you're plausibly investigating an obstruction of justice, it doesn't seem to me what authority you have to conduct an investigation at all, right? I mean, you have to tether it to some criminal predicate.
It may not just be the president whom he's investigating on that.
Right, that's right. I just think the longer the period in which he's acting with a corrupt motive, the more possibilities that there are actions that are not reasonably encompassed within, for example, his authorities as president. So everybody focuses on the firing of Jim Comey as the act that is itself, you know, that is ultimately obstructive. But, you know, as Bill Clinton and Richard Nixon showed, there are ways to obstruct justice as president that are indisputably obstructions of justice, like witness tampering and, lying. And You know, so I think that one of the things about this set of episodes is that the longer the list of presidential actions that you have that seem to have corrupt motives or inappropriate motives, the higher salience will be that one slip where when they finally interview him, or maybe the more than one slip where he isn't entirely truthful, that then all gets set against a background of highly improper behavior that becomes atmospherically very important. Or, you know, there was that report back from Mike Isikoff in the spring that the president had told Flynn to stay strong long after he had been fired, had called him and told him to stay strong. You know, that takes on a very different color if the president is calling Jeff Sessions or getting McGahn to go to Jeff Sessions and lobby him not to recuse, if he's disparaging the entire premise of the investigation as a possible reason to fire the FBI director, and if he's boasting to the Russians that he got rid of the FBI director and it relieved a lot of pressure on himself. And so I think, we've all assumed that the obstructions are these acts that are reasonably encompassed within his authority as president. But every time I read one of these stories, I'm actually looking for the act that is not within that. And interestingly, that's not in this story.
I actually think that's an important point. And I do think there are sort of hints that get at exactly the kind of issue that Ben is talking about. So one is related to sort of this, the memo that was drafted in New Jersey. And it references the fact that White House officials, you know, have said to reporters that letter did not reference Russia or the FBI investigation. You know, now Schmidt is reporting that, according to two people who've read it, the letter's first sentence says the Russia investigation was fabricated and politically motivated. Now, it's not a crime to lie to a reporter, but the fact that somebody lied to a reporter does raise the question about whether or not they sort of contemporaneously also lied to congressional investigators or lied to the FBI. So I do think that those statements become more interesting. You know, this is, it also really does put sort of the Rod Rosenstein memo in an even more negative light. And I'll offer up one question from Josh Blackman, who requested that we talk about this on the podcast. And what he was saying, referring to sort of this story that Trump was told that he needed cause to remove Comey, would that explain why he had asked Rosenstein to prepare the letter that cited the Hillary Clinton email issue as a reason for removal? So whenever we have sort of these other sort of color stories, what are the various episodes that we should sort of think back through and say, well, wait a minute, maybe that's why he did it, and does that sort of put his various motives in a more nefarious or I guess more innocent light?
Well, I wonder if I could just add a reservation to this whole question of, or a qualification to this whole question of what he might have meant when he referred to the Russia investigation. We're assuming, or some people assume when they talk about that he just means the entire hullabaloo about Russia, which he thinks is a hoax and politically motivated. But we also know that it may not have only been that he was unhappy with Comey for not publicly exonerating him at the hearing. He also might have been extremely unhappy with Comey for not having let Flynn go. I mean, he made a point of trying to get Comey to go light on Flynn, to let him off, to recognize that he was a good man, even if he might have made some mistakes. Now, since those stories first surfaced, we know that Flynn lied to the FBI. And we don't know to this day what it is that the president knew about those lies, why he thought that Flynn told those lies, whether he was in on it at the beginning or found out about it only later. But certainly, his frustration with Comey could have had as much to do with that as it had with some generalized frustration that Comey wasn't, helping him build his hoax narrative. And of course, if Trump did have any hand in Flynn lying to the FBI, and if there are some very good reasons he had why he wanted Flynn to lie to the FBI, or at least reasons he thought he had, good reasons as far as he was concerned that he had for Flynn lying to the FBI, then I think, Ben, he's certainly operating outside that zone of protected constitutional authority that you were referring to earlier.
So just in response to what Bob said and tying it into what you said earlier, I kind of agree with both of those points, that the further he steps outside of his sort of official executive responsibilities or is not obviously exercising those, then it becomes more problematic in some normative universe. I just think that we make a mistake when we slip into, and I think Schmidt does in his story, talking about whether Mueller is going to bring a case. I mean, this stuff is all going to be relevant in my view, and it will be couched in legal arguments, but it's all going to be relevant for the audience of the Congress and the American people. That's the only point I meant to make. And so, I mean, I agree with you that the buildup of evidence is relevant, that despite its ambiguity, to the extent it looks corrupt and it has these other motives that you've been talking about, I mean, the story's building up definitely to have that flavor. I just don't think that we should be focusing just on it. I think there's no discriminator out there, only in a sharp legal lens. If I could just go back to what Susan said, I think Josh's question is a great one. I hadn't thought about that, but it's quite possible that if Trump believed that he needed cause for some reason to get rid of Comey, it wasn't a kind of at-will firing, so to speak, that maybe the Rosenstein memo, which was, it's always been strange and strangely presented, was the pretext for that. And I just want to point out that one of the strangest things in the story is that it says that it seems to suggest that Rosenstein was the one that may have initiated the firing. Schmidt talks about, it implies that that might be the case. Schmidt says that Rosenstein pulled one of Mr. McGahn's deputies aside after a meeting at the Justice Department and told that aide that the White House and Justice Department lawyers needed to discuss Comey's future. So it sounds like Rosenstein was, for whatever reason, initiating a meeting about Comey's future. And then, in this very strange phrase, Schmidt says it's unclear whether this conversation was related to the effort to dig up dirt on Mr. Comey, which they referred to earlier in the story, that Jeff Sessions said he wanted a negative story each day on Jim Comey. So that's actually a new piece of information, I think, and I think it puts Rosenstein into this episode and the firing of Comey in a stranger and even dimmer light, in my opinion.
Yeah, so I have a couple thoughts on that. First of all, it puts Rosenstein's conduct in a dimmer light, but secondly, the whole episode, and this is one of the few facts in the story that is actually denied. So the story is quite precise, that an aide to Sessions goes to a Capitol Hill staffer asking whether the staffer has dirt on the FBI director, and specifically saying that Sessions wanted one pejorative story a day in the press about Comey. The Justice Department denies that the incident happened, and it denies it on the record. And then the story says that Rosenstein, earlier that same day, had this interaction with one of McGahn's aides or deputies, and that it's unclear whether that was related to dig up dirt. So a few sourcing notes on that. One is, I'm really confident that the New York Times would not have run with that episode in the face of an on-the-record Justice Department denial unless they were really, really confident that it had taken place. And so, it's a very interesting little bit of sourcing. And then it is sourced to a person with knowledge of the meeting, which, means, I suppose, could be from the congressional side, could be from the executive branch side, and or could be somebody with, I suppose, with secondhand knowledge of the meeting, though that's a little bit hard for me to believe that would be strong enough given the on-the-record denial. So I think the New York Times is all but saying here that the Justice Department is not telling the truth about this incident. I mean, I don't know how to read it another way.
I agree with that, that seems like the plausible read. You know, the other sort of interesting tidbit that's in here is that, you know, Mueller has substantiated elements of the allegations Comey puts forth in his in the memos that he documented about sort of the improper conduct and contacts with the president. You know, this is, the timing is especially notable if you look at what's happening in Congress. So Senator Grassley is trying to really just in the past sort of 24 hours sort of raise new questions about whether or not one of the Comey memos contained classified information. He's doing this in a really bizarre way of that Dan Richmond had said in an interview that he had four memos and there were seven total, and his staff thought that there were four memos with classified information and therefore there had to be one. Really this sort of like very attenuated thing that he's now making requests into the Justice Department about. So it's sort of, it looks like an effort to sort of collaterally attack the Comey memos as, you know, having been careless with classified information. I think sort of a claim that's almost absurd on its face. Sort of the timing of that, I think, is notable in light of sort of a new revelation that, hey, Mueller now has, you know, other forms of substantiation, including, you know, Reince Priebus's own notes, right? So it's not just sort of FBI documentation, but actually documentation from the president's own team.
So I want to get each of your thoughts on, like, to what extent this changes in any gross way our understanding of this sequence of events. I mean, does Bob, get us started? Is this just added texture to what we already knew? Or when you put all this stuff together, is it a deeper, like, does it change fundamentally some aspect of how we understand these events?
I don't think it changes fundamentally. It does add some color and some texture and, you know, the peculiar story about the lawyer who purportedly withheld the legal conclusion, the AG planting negative stories, or at least the AG's aide suggesting the planting of daily negative stories about the FBI director. So it certainly gives you a better sense of the kinds of pressures that we're building in the White House and the president's manic focus on protecting himself. The one point I'd like to tease out, and it goes back to Jack's question about, you know, whether the president can be indicted for for obstruction, is a suggestion somewhere in the story that the evidence may be building on the obstruction side, but it's not particularly substantial on the collusion side. And it's always been my assumption, and this story doesn't change it, that it's going to be very difficult for Mueller to bring an obstruction case if there is not a significant connection to collusion. The farther we are away from a collusion case, the more the president's lawyers can build up the point that he was just justifiably frustrated with an investigation that was just largely smoke, that it was, you know, built up by his political enemies and made a big deal of in the press. I think that to bring an obstruction charge against the president, and I'm in the minority here, I think that he is subject to indictment, although I recognize there's a lot of sound opinion on the other side. But it seems to me to bring a case against him, if in fact the president is sort of whirling around and ultimately in a perverse way justified in believing that nothing like this so-called collusion actually occurred, and therefore why is he being put through this in the first year of his term? You know, I think it just makes it that much harder for Mueller to take these kinds of facts and proceed with an obstruction case, taking into account Jack's point about it's no easy matter for him to bring in an obstruction case in the first place.
Jack, what do you think? Does this story fundamentally change anything for you, or is it just a whole lot of...
It didn't fundamentally change anything for me. I tell you the big takeaway I took away from the story, and this is something that was driven home by Bob's answer to your first question about if he were asked, you know, hypothetically a similar question. I mean, it's, you know, Trump is complaining in the story just the way he complained to Schmidt in his ad hoc interview a week or two ago that his attorney general wasn't protecting him like Bobby Kennedy protected JFK and like he said Holder protected Obama. And, you know, I understand Trump's frustration in the following sense. attorneys general for a long time. Most of them have had very, very close, many of them have had very close relations with the president. And while there's especially been a norm of independence since Watergate, it's also true that, you know, at the margins, the attorney general will exercise discretion to exercise the president's policies, even without the president sort of hitting him over the head with it. And on very sensitive things, there are ways for the White House to send a signal of concern or anxiety, I think, that an attorney general might pick up on. And that might have been, in Bob's hypothetical, what a White House counsel doing this properly would have done. And the amazing thing is about the Trump administration is that they just don't know how to do that. You know, Trump, instead of, he didn't have an attorney general who could pick up on those signals. He didn't have an attorney general that, it turned out, had the type of loyalty he hoped for. And he didn't ask his White House counsel to sort of seek information in a way that would have sent a subtle message. And his White House counsel didn't, according to this story, exercise that kind of prudential judgment to not leave themselves open to an embarrassing, if not incriminating, story like this.
What would be an example, Jack, of, you know, people having the same instincts as Trump is exhibiting here that you're saying are kind of understandable, that people, you know, but that plays out in a way that doesn't sound like, you know, a 3-year-old having a temper tantrum?
When Ashcroft recused himself on what became the Fitzgerald investigation in the Bush administration, without talking about it too much, it's inconceivable to me, and I was in the Justice Department at the time, although I was not working on that at all, it's inconceivable to me that the Bush White House would have brought pressure on Ashcroft to recuse himself, overt pressure, and it's inconceivable that Ashcroft would have reacted well to that.
But they were angry.
By all reports, they were angry, and you could certainly feel it in the air in the White House when I walked into it. But no one ever said it, and it was never overt. And of course, any administration would not be happy about being investigated, especially if they thought it was an unjustified investigation. But the point is, you just don't send your White House counsel to the Justice Department to lobby the Attorney General not to recuse himself from an investigation of the White House. You just don't, that's not the way one would do something like that. And that's what apparently happened here. And so it's an example, I don't know what to make of the example. It's an example of they just don't have the right etiquette and they don't have good judgment, and, or is it a lack of values, or is it something, or are they really trying to construct justice? I mean, it's hard to read what's going on here.
Susan, what do you think? Is there anything in any way in which this fundamentally changes your view of the story?
No, so I tend to agree, right? This isn't game changing. I do think it sort of moves the ball forward in that kind of very small incremental way that the stories that have just had kind of added to the body of knowledge have. You know, look, it refutes the notion that Comey's firing is like the result of political naivete. This is something that had sort of been floated as, especially in explaining Jared Kushner's role. You know, they thought that this is, you know, Democrats were angry too, and it was sort of no big deal. You know, we see lots of evidence of really, really senior officials very strongly pushing back, trying to manage this. Now, maybe that's not consequential for the president, but it could be whenever you start to think about, well, what about obstruction as applied to other senior officials? You know, the other thing that I think this does demonstrate, although, again, I think it was obvious before, is, you know, the Comey's firing was intensely tied to Trump's feelings about Russia. And that means that the White House lied about it, right? They, you know, the press secretary expressly said this wasn't about Russia, nothing to do about with Russia. It was all about this Rod Rosenstein memo. It was because of Rod Rosenstein's recommendation. I know that's like almost a quaint idea at this point, but it's actually a really big deal for the White House to know lie to the American people, you know, and I just don't think we should lose track of that. The one other piece that I do think is sort of interesting and requires some mulling over is, you know, this, to the extent that this anecdote about Rosenstein's sort of early participation potentially in digging up dirt about Comey ends up being accurate, you know, this does place Rosenstein in a far more central way in the early decision-making about firing Comey. You know, that means he is potentially relevant as a witness in this investigation. So it does start to sort of raise some uncomfortable questions about his role in overseeing the special counsel investigation, since we're getting more information about sort of the degree in which he's actually tied to to the conduct that's actually being examined as part of the investigation. I don't know that we've reached a point in which sort of calls for his recusal are appropriate, but I do think that it's there's a rising discomfort there.
Final thoughts, Jack. Where do you think this goes from here? What's the next set of questions or the next steps?
I don't know what the next set of questions or the next step is. I just want to make a comment on, in wrapping up, on my overall reaction to the piece in light of what Schmidt said at the end of his discussion at the beginning. When he said during his interview, he didn't think the president cared about the optics of when he talks as if he's trying to stop the investigation and maybe improperly. You know, you wrote, Ben, back over a year ago that the Trump administration was characterized by malevolence tempered by incompetence. And there's a way to read almost all of what they've done. Sometimes I think in watching the president and his obliviousness to how he appears, that maybe it's just massive incompetence and that no one can control him, and that, you know, McGahn couldn't have exercised any better judgment because the president just ordered him to go over and do what he did to Sessions. I mean, I'm not saying I believe this, but there's so much evidence of incompetence that and it's that the whole thing might just be explained by incompetence. I'm not suggesting that's the case, but in a way, there's so many things in this story that events incompetence that it makes me think that maybe a lot of what's going on here.
Susan, final thoughts?
Yeah, so like Jack, I have zero predictions on where it goes next. I think the one thing we can say is that sort of Ty Cobb's prediction that this is going to be wrapped by the end of last year or in the near future has been proven pretty resoundingly wrong. You know, all of the sort of the indications in this story and what are, I would imagine, are forthcoming stories as well, is that, you know, look, this investigation is just getting started, and that we're likely to see, at least on the Senate side in Congress, that investigation to go on for a very long time as well. So I think that that's sort of the most we can confidently predict, is that there's a lot of stuff we don't know that Mueller or congressional investigators know, and this is going to be an issue, you know, both the collusion question and the obstruction question, that just absolutely dogs this president, you know, sort of at least through the next year and possibly beyond that.
Bob, final thought.
My final thought connects somewhat to Jack's observations about what may be going on here. I certainly wouldn't rule out the staggering incompetence theory, but I also think that you have somebody who has been without interruption for decades in completely unrelated lines of work, whatever his other limitations, and they seem to be many and deep. He does not understand government. He thinks of the United States government. He has thought of the United States government that he's running as the largest corporation he's ever been in charge of. He looks at the lawyers that way. He looks at the staff that way. He thinks of his Article II authority in the same way that he thinks of whatever powers are conferred upon him by his corporate organizing documents. And I think it's you know, a case of somebody who's just not going to be able to learn new tricks when you add to that what I think his fundamental limitations are.
I really agree. I think that's a very shrewd and insightful comment by Bob. I think that's exactly right. He's written about that issue. I think it kind of explains why the president was saying to Schmidt, kind of bragging to Schmidt, that he can do whatever he wants with his Justice Department. The astonishing thing is he can't do whatever he wants with his Justice Department. That's what this story makes quite clear. And he can't, and he's just been completely ineffective in getting the Justice Department to do what he wants it to do. So it's a remarkable study about how a president has really not learned. He really doesn't understand what the presidency is or how it works, and this story is just another example of that.
So I do have a prediction based on this story, and it flows out of, frankly, not anything about my knowledge of of government, but about my suspicions based on experience in journalism, which is that the most novel aspects of this story are about stuff that went on at the Justice Department, and specifically the story about Sessions seeking dirt on Comey and the odd possible interaction of that with Rod Rosenstein's stuff. And I believe that a lot of reporters read that tonight and immediately called all their sources. And that will be the next area that you will see a lot of journalistic attention to. I have no basis for saying that other than if I were still a working reporter and I had read this story, I would have called everybody I knew, both on the Hill side and on the Justice Department side, to try to flesh out that aspect of the story. So I will be looking for news on that in the coming days. With that, thank you all for joining us on short notice. This has been a special edition of the Lawfare Podcast. If you are new to the Lawfare Podcast or not, please leave it a rating on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever podcast distribution service you use. And, you know, we don't do any advertising, any promotion, so we rely on you guys to tweet about the Lawfare Podcast or share it on Facebook or, tell a friend about it. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back on Saturday with our regular...
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.